law firms. Hitler's fascist party in Germany called this effort bringing it into line. What we're going to do today is examine Trump's efforts to dominate the major law firms in America. He has succeeded in dominating some, but not all of these law firms, which were known as Big Law. The resistance has been impressive and a tribute to the spirit of fairness in the American legal tradition. What did Trump do? He told the big law firms that he would sign an executive order banning them from federal buildings, including the courthouses where they practice law. Further, he would take away their security clearances, and he'd cancel any contracts that they had with the federal government. This was calculated to break these firms, and they knew it. A target was the venerable firm of Paul Weiss, established in 1875, which was active in the civil rights movement in the 50s. It helped to win the landmark desegregation victory in Brown versus the Board of Education. Paul Weiss initially tried to resist. It asked other firms for help, but to no avail. The other firms refused and instead began to pick off the Paul Weiss clients. Faced with financial ruin, Paul Weiss gave in and agreed to donate millions of dollars in free legal work to
get started. I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York and Geneva, Switzerland, this is Democracy Now!
It is really quite disgusting that you give tax breaks to people who don't need it. You throw 16 million people off the health care that they have. You cut nutrition programs for hungry kids. You make it harder for working class young people to afford to go to college. This is really an obscene piece of legislation.
Senate Republicans are racing to push through President Trump's massive 940-page long so-called Big Beautiful Bill. If passed, the richest Americans and corporations will receive huge tax breaks, and a projected 12 million Americans will lose their health care. We'll speak to David Dane, editor of The American Prospect, and Dr. Adam Gaffney, former president of Physicians for a National Health Program. And then to the Supreme Court.
I want to thank Justice Barrett, who wrote the opinion brilliantly, as well as Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Alito, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Thomas. Great people. Thanks for this decision, and thanks to this decision, we can now promptly file to proceed with numerous policies that have been wrongly enjoined on a nationwide basis.
The blockbuster term ended Friday with another 6-3 decision by the conservative majority that significantly limits the ability of lower courts to be a check on presidential power. We'll talk to Dahlia Lithwick of Slate and ACLU attorney Chase Strangio. And in the Human Rights Council in Geneva, a Sahrawi tent of cultural resistance has been erected, made from the dresses of 19 Sahrawi human rights defenders from the occupied Western Sahara.
Khaymitna is actually a mini version of the tent where I grew up in the Sahrawi refugee camps. So this is a mini version of it. And this is a storytelling, a human rights storytelling project, which both convey the story of Sahrawis, their identity and their culture.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Tens of thousands of Palestinians fled central and northern Gaza on Sunday after Israel issued new forced evacuation orders and began bombing eastern parts of Gaza City. Israel's stepped-up campaign follows another bloody weekend that saw scores of Palestinian civilians killed, including children huddled in tents, families taking shelter at a sports stadium, and starving Palestinians seeking food at militarized aid distribution sites. In Jabalia, rescue teams pulled at least 15 bodies from the rubble of a home leveled by an Israeli airstrike Sunday morning.
Today they forced us to leave.
ordered us to evacuate and then bombed us with shells and warplanes. Just as we were about to flee, they brought our homes down on us. What do they want from us? Let them tell us what they want. Enough is enough. About 10 people were killed in the house, most of them children.
Earlier today, 10 Palestinians were killed as they sought to collect food at an aid site in Gaza City. Two more were shot dead at an aid distribution center in Rafah. The killings came after Haaretz reported Israeli officers and soldiers said they were ordered to fire at unarmed crowds near food distribution sites in Gaza, even when no threat was present. Gaza's health ministry reports such attacks have killed over 500 Palestinians since May. Meanwhile, an Israeli court in Jerusalem has cancelled hearings this week in Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's trial, where he faces charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. The court's decision came just days after President Trump called for the charges to be thrown out. Russia launched hundreds of drones and missiles at Ukraine overnight Sunday in what Kyiv is calling Russia's largest aerial assault since its full-scale invasion. The attacks killed at least four civilians and targeted regions far from the front lines, including in western Ukraine, prompting Poland and its NATO allies to scramble jets along the border. Separately, Ukraine's Air Force said a pilot died when his F-16 jet crashed. Meanwhile, Russia's military said it seized more settlements in Ukraine's east. And for the first time, Russian forces have occupied a village in the east-central Dnipropetrovsk region. In Kyiv, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky signed a decree Sunday withdrawing Ukraine from the Ottawa Convention, which bans the use of landmines.
This concerns all those countries which border Russia. Anti-personnel mines are the instrument which often cannot be substituted by something else for defense purposes.
On Friday, the governments of Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia announced they too would withdraw from the mine ban treaty following similar moves by Finland and Poland. Meanwhile, Denmark has expanded its military draft to include women for the first time. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that lower court judges will no longer have the power to issue nationwide injunctions, not even to stop the president from taking illegal actions. The case stems from Trump's attempts to bar birthright citizenship, a right guaranteed under the 14th Amendment. After three federal judges blocked Trump's executive order, the Trump administration sought emergency relief from the Supreme Court. On Friday, the court's far-right majority granted that relief in a 6-3 ruling, severely curtailing the power of district and appellate judges to prevent the government from enforcing laws or policies that violate the Constitution. The ruling overturns decades of precedent. In a scathing dissent, Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote, quote, "No right is safe in the new legal regime the court creates. Today, the threat is to birthright citizenship. Tomorrow, a different administration may try to seize firearms from law-abiding citizens or prevent people of certain faiths from gathering to worship," she said. In a separate ruling Friday, the Supreme Court sided with parents in Maryland who objected to LGBTQ+ books in schools on religious grounds. We'll have more on the Supreme Court later in the broadcast. On Capitol Hill, senators are debating President Trump's 940-page so-called Big Beautiful Bill following an all-night session that stretched into Monday morning. Republicans are racing to meet a Trump-imposed July 4th deadline to sign the package into law. The Senate Republican version of the legislation makes deeper cuts to Medicaid and health care, with the Congressional Budget Office estimating some 11.8 million people will lose coverage as Republicans propose more than $1 trillion in cuts to Medicaid alone. The CBO also warns the current bill will increase the U.S. debt deficit by an estimated $3.3 trillion over the next decade. Meanwhile, the legislation not only ends subsidies for renewable power sources, but would see a new tax applied to solar and wind projects. Senator Bernie Sanders spoke out against the bill in a social media post Sunday.
It is really quite disgusting that you give tax breaks to people who don't need it. You throw 16 million people off the health care that they have. You cut nutrition programs for hungry kids. You make it harder for working class young people to afford to go to college. This is really an obscene piece of legislation.
We'll have more on the Republican budget reconciliation bill after headlines. North Carolina Republican Senator Tom Tillis said Sunday he will not seek re-election when his term expires next year. Tillis's announcement came after he refused to support Trump's budget reconciliation bill in a procedural vote on Saturday. That prompted an angry response from President Trump, who took to social media to hurl insults at Senator Tillis while threatening to support a primary challenger. The Trump administration said Friday it's terminating temporary protected status, or TPS, for over 500,000 immigrants from Haiti who will face deportation when the relief is set to end in September. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem claimed Haiti is safe and no longer meets the requirements for TPS as conditions have improved in the country. Haitians first received the relief following the devastating 2010 earthquake. Since then, worsening gang violence and political instability, fueled by foreign intervention, has led to a worsening humanitarian crisis in Haiti. According to the International Organization for Migration, as of May, more than 1.3 million people in Haiti are internally displaced, many fleeing armed gangs that now control most of Port-au-Prince. Gerline Joseph, executive director of Haitian Bridge Alliance, said in a statement, quote, sending back hundreds of thousands of people to a country overrun by gangs, where hospitals are shuttered and food is scarce, is a direct assault on black immigrant communities. It's not about policy. It's about dehumanization. This comes as a San Diego federal judge ruled Friday that the Trump administration cannot deport thousands of asylum-seeking families who were separated under Trump's first term and are plaintiffs in a settled lawsuit against the federal government. ACLU attorney Lee Gallant, who represents the families, said the administration has provided no information on plaintiffs who have been detained or removed from the U.S. The ACLU confirmed at least one child who was separated from his parents under Trump's so-called zero-tolerance policy had already been deported. U.S. District Judge Dana Sabro earlier this month found the Trump administration had already violated terms of the 2023 settlement. Over 1,000 immigrant children taken from their parents in Trump's first term still have not been reunited with their families. The president of the University of Virginia has stepped down under pressure from the Trump administration. Amid a Justice Department investigation into its diversity, equity, and inclusion practices. The abrupt resignation of President James Ryan on Friday came after the Justice Department threatened to block all federal funds to UVA if Ryan remained in office. That's despite the fact that the university's governing board voted last March to close its DEI office and end all diversity policies in admissions, employment, and financial aid. The Trump administration says it is ending the 2001 Roadless Area Conservation Rule, which protects nearly 60 million acres in the national forest system from logging and the construction of new roads. The environmental law group Earth Justice has promised a legal challenge. The Sierra Club's forest campaign blasted the decision, writing, quote, once again, the Trump administration is ignoring the voices of millions of Americans to pursue a corporate giveaway for Trump's billionaire buddies. Canada's government scrapped a 3% tax on technology companies' revenue on Sunday, mere hours before it was due to take effect. The reversal came after President Trump said Friday he would pause U.S.-Canada trade talks and would set a new tariff rate on Canadian goods within the next week. Canada's digital services tax would have raised billions of dollars of revenue annually from U.S. tech giants like Amazon, Meta, and Apple. And millions of people across the globe took to the streets to mark Pride celebrations over the weekend, with many defying government crackdowns on LGBTQ plus communities. In Turkey, police arrested over 50 people Sunday ahead of a banned Pride march in Istanbul. In Hungary, Saturday's march drew an estimated 100,000 people in what is being described as the largest LGBTQ plus pride celebration in Hungarian history. The peaceful gathering came as an act of defiance against Prime Minister Viktor Orban and his government's anti-LGBTQ plus policies.
It is this year that the situation got so toxic in Hungary, including in Budapest, that now we need to make our voices heard a little more loudly, I think. Definitely peacefully, but we need to be present and need to be out in the streets.
Here in New York, an estimated 1 million people joined Pride celebrations over the weekend. As the gatherings wound down Sunday night, two teens were shot and injured near the historic Stonewall Inn, site of the 1969 uprising that launched the LGBTQ rights movement. No arrests have been made. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh in New York, joined by Amy Goodman in Geneva. Hi, Amy.
Hello, Nermeen, and hello to all of our listeners and viewers and readers around the United States and around the world. Yes, I am in Geneva, Switzerland, broadcasting from the UN Human Rights Council. We're going to go to the council at the end of the broadcast, but we're going to begin now in the United States. Yes, right here, in an all-night session that will stretch until today, senators have begun debate on President Trump's 940-page so-called Big Beautiful Bill. That's the budget bill. As Republicans race to meet a Trump-imposed July 4th deadline and are set to vote on key amendments. This comes after a procedural vote this weekend was delayed for hours as Republicans hashed out details before a 51-49 vote that saw two Republicans join all the Democrats in opposition. Rand Paul of Kentucky and Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina also announced, Tom Tillis announced, he does not plan to seek re-election. Tillis spoke on the Senate floor.
It's inescapable that this bill in its current form will betray the very promise that Donald J. Trump made.
The Senate Republicans' version of the bill makes deeper cuts to Medicaid and health care, even after Trump vowed not to touch Medicaid. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimates nearly 12 million people will lose care under the current version of the bill, especially children, people with disabilities, and senior citizens. Meanwhile, the CBO says the bill will add at least $3.3 trillion to the already bulging national debt over a decade. Speaking from the Senate floor, independent Senator Bernie Sanders called it the most dangerous piece of legislation in modern U.S. history.
Actually, though, Mr. President, I'm wrong. This is not a gift to the billionaire class. They paid for it. This bill is an absolute reflection of a corrupt campaign finance system which allows billionaires to buy elections. And when billionaires spend hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars trying to elect a president or a senator or a member of Congress, they're not making that investment just for the fun of it. They want something in return, and this legislation, big time, is what they are getting in return.
Ahead of today's Votorama on amendments in the bill, which includes some $4 trillion in tax cuts, Senator Bernie Sanders spoke out again in a post on social media Sunday evening.
It is really quite disgusting that you give tax breaks to people who don't need it. You throw 16 million people off the health care that they have. You cut nutrition programs for hungry kids. You make it harder for working class young people to afford to go to college. This is really an obscene piece of legislation.
Meanwhile, on Sunday, the Senate parliamentarian ruled against two key carve-outs on Medicaid spending for senators in Alaska and Hawaii. And it's now unclear how Alaska Republican Lisa Murkowski will vote. For more, we're joined by two guests. David Dane is executive editor of The American Prospect, where his latest piece is headlined, Murkowski's Alaska Gold Rush Loses Some Gold Plating. And in Boston, we're joined by Dr. Adam Gaffney, a critical care physician and professor at Harvard Medical School. He just published an analysis in the Annals of Internal Medicine that showed how provisions in the House version of the bill passed last month, including Medicaid work requirements, would lead to the loss of coverage for millions. Gaffney is also the immediate past president of Physicians for National Health Program. Welcome back to Democracy Now! To both of you. David Dane, let's begin with you. If you could elaborate on what the key provisions in this bill are and what the implications might be in the event that it's passed.
Well, it's going to affect every American, pretty much. What you have here is an extension of the Trump tax cuts from 2017. They were primarily targeted to the wealthy. Then you add in new tax cuts that were pitched by Donald Trump during the campaign. No tax on tips, no tax on overtime, along with a lot of business tax cuts that the Senate wanted to make permanent. That massive tax cuts is what creates this huge gap in terms of the deficit. But on top of that, you have the largest ever cut of Medicaid in American history. You have the largest ever cut to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program in American history. You have a change to higher education, particularly student loans, that will make getting an education become more expensive. And then you'll see not only the loss of most clean energy tax credits, but new taxes that have been described as a kill shot for solar and wind, and we should expect much higher electricity costs and rolling blackouts. Meanwhile, there are the tax credits for the kind of coal that is used in steel, and there's a big tax break for big oil that would allow domestic oil drillers to not pay any taxes at all. So you put that all together, and it's almost hard to take in and describe, but basically, you have Republicans taking food and medicine and other things away from vulnerable people in order to finance tax cuts for the rich. And that's really the bottom line.
David Dane, before we go to Dr. Adam Gaffney to talk about the stunning, horrifying tax cuts to Medicaid, I wanted to ask you about this point you made. It's not only about cutting tax breaks to encourage, you know, tax incentives to encourage renewables. It's actually increasing taxes on them. Explain the poison pill here.
That's correct. The tax credits that are being cut are all from the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022. And those gave incentives to produce and install renewable energy. Those are all going away. But there is this new tax on solar and wind, that they can only get out of if they show they are not using any materials that are produced by a so-called foreign entity of concern. This really means China. It only gives 2 years. Basically, these taxes would start in 2027. And right now, supply chains for solar and wind energy at least have some component that is Chinese. And so there's very little time to create a domestic supply chain, especially because the production tax credits for domestic solar manufacturers are going away. So it makes it harder to build those factories. So, people in the industry have said that this is going to make it really ineffective, cost ineffective to build solar and wind products. And those projects are probably going to go away. You're talking about multiple gigawatts of projects that are going to go out of business. They aren't going to be built. And this is at a time when, because of data centers and because of increased electricity demand, we need those projects that can be spun up quickly. And so that is why the expectation is for much higher electricity costs and possibly rolling blackouts, because the grid simply can't handle the demand that we have right now. And if we can't quickly build new energy sources, we're going to face a shortfall.
So let's bring Dr. Adam Gaffney into this conversation, a professor at Harvard Medical School, a critical care physician, a past president of Physicians for a National Health Program, and author of To Heal Humankind, hardly what this bill is about. But if you can talk about, well, you just came out with a new study in the Annals of Internal Medicine, and talk about Medicaid. How is it that people were thinking that the Senate wasn't going to move forward on massive Medicaid cuts? But what this means in terms of lives and who exactly is targeted as trillions of dollars in tax breaks are being offered to America's wealthiest?
Well, look, these cuts to Medicaid would be absolutely devastating to the American healthcare safety net. And the implications of that are exactly as what you'd expect. As you said, nearly 12 million people would lose health coverage as a result of the Senate bill, even more than the House bill. In our study, we estimate this translates to, 1.9 million Americans losing their doctor, 1.3 million Americans going without needed medications, 1.2 million Americans being saddled with medical debt, 380,000 women not going without their needed mammograms, and biggest of all, we estimate more than 16,500 deaths annually as a result of the coverage losses that would be inflicted by the so-called Big Beautiful Bill Act. These are not surprising results. We know that modern medical care saves lives, but they are very disturbing results. And they speak to the fact that the lives of working class Americans are being weighed as less important than tax cuts for billionaires. It's quite disturbing.
And Dr. Gaffney, and indeed, these are the largest reductions in Medicaid since it was created in 1965. So if you could just explain, who are the principal beneficiaries of Medicaid and who will become ineligible if this bill were to pass?
Medicaid covers low-income Americans across demographic groups, chronically ill, disabled, people who require long-term care, including the elderly, children, pregnant people, and many, many working age adults. Probably the biggest impact would fall on that last group. The Medicaid work requirements, the so-called Medicaid work requirements, would impose a giant bundle of red tape between Americans and their health care, probably causing around 5 million to become uninsured. These are the casualties of red tape, because most of these individuals are either working or have a very good reason not to work, like they're too sick or they're taking care of a child. So you will see coverage losses in multiple groups, but many of them will fall on working age folks. But again, there are, for instance, elderly individuals who rely on Medicaid to keep down the cost of their medications. They would be impacted, and really a very wide variety. Don't forget, too, it's not only Medicaid cuts. There's also changes to the Affordable Care Act marketplace plans, so-called Obamacare plans, that would make millions more lose coverage on top of what we looked at, which was just Medicaid. So you're looking at a lot of people.
And Dr. Gaffney, you've also pointed out that this will have not only massively injurious effects to the people who are on Medicaid, but also on hospital providers, rural hospitals, doctors, nurses. If you could explain how.
Sure. Well, listen, many hospitals in this country focus on the care of disadvantaged groups. Poor people, people in rural areas, as you said. And as a result, these hospitals rely on Medicaid for their revenues, for their operating revenues. So what happens when you take a sledgehammer to that foundation? We know what happens. They have to make cuts. They have to cut staff. They have to cut services, or in a worst case scenario, even close. And this is compounding an already existing problem where there isn't the healthcare infrastructure that we need in more disadvantaged areas. So this means that people will be affected, even who don't lose coverage. Even those of us who don't rely on Medicaid or the Affordable Care Act could be impacted if the hospital in our area closes and we have no access to care. So this bill would really devastate, again, the American healthcare safety net, such as it is. I would only add, it's important to recognize this is on top of existing problems in our healthcare system. You know, I'm a critical care doctor. I work in the ICU. I see patients with life-threatening complications of untreated illness because they didn't get care because they couldn't afford it. What happens when we add to that number massively? You'll have many more of those sorts of patients winding up in the ICUs of doctors like me, and it was not necessary.
David Dane, we just have about 30 seconds, but what happens next? It's really hard to follow the meanderings of this bill. Do you see it going down? You have Tom Tillis saying he's retiring under tremendous pressure from President Trump. What's going to happen here?
Well, the Senate's going to vote all day on amendments, perhaps even into tonight and tomorrow morning. There are some key senators to watch: Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski. Murkowski from Alaska got a number of perks in the bill, including a special tax break for whaling captains in Alaska. We're going to see if, because some of those perks were stripped away, including all of the Medicaid boosts that were put in for Alaska. So we're going to see if she holds to that deal. Collins has said she's leaning no, but pending amendments. So we'll see if she gets amendments. And then the House, both the Freedom Caucus, the hard right hardliners who want to see less deficits and debt, and also some of the moderates who don't want to see these Medicaid cuts, have also spoken out against it. So there's still a needle to thread here for Republicans. But you have to expect that a bill that extends a bunch of tax cuts and cuts a bunch of spending on the poor is going to be somewhat acceptable to Republicans. So I fear that the differences, especially after Donald Trump sort of bears down on everybody, will go away, and we will see some version of this pass.
David Dane, thank you so much for joining us, the American Prospect, and Dr. Adam Gaffney, Harvard Medical School former president of Physicians for a National Health Program. Up next, the Supreme Court's term has ended with more blockbuster 6-3 decisions. Stay with us.
Mon amour, ma chérie, je pense à toi, mon amour, ma bien-aimée, ne m'abandonne pas, mon amour, ma chérie.
Amadou and Mariam performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh in New York with Amy Goodman in Geneva, broadcasting from the UN Human Rights Council. The Supreme Court's term ended Friday with a decision that promises to further expand the power of the president. The case, Trump versus Casa, looks at President Trump's effort to end birthright citizenship, a well-established constitutional right, with the stroke of a pen,
an executive order. The court did not rule on the merits of the case. Instead, the 6-3 majority weighed in only on the authority of lower courts to restrain presidential power through the use of universal injunctions. Justice Amy Coney Barrett wrote for the majority. The decision will also clear the way for other presidential policies previously blocked by universal injunction to go ahead, barring other legal means are found to prevent them from doing so. President Trump acknowledged the broad implications the ruling would have on his agenda at a press conference on Friday, where he also thanked the justices in the majority.
So thanks to this decision, we can now properly file to proceed with these numerous policies and those that have been wrongly enjoined on a nationwide basis, including birthright citizenship, ending sanctuary city funding, suspending refugee resettlement, freezing unnecessary funding, stopping federal taxpayers from paying for transgender surgeries, and numerous other priorities of the American people. This is a decision that covers a tremendous amount of territory. But I want to just thank again the Supreme Court for this ruling. It's a giant. It's a giant. And they should be very proud, and our country should be very proud of the Supreme Court today.
Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote for the three justices in the minority. She said, quote, "No right is safe in the new legal regime the court creates. Today, the threat is to birthright citizenship. Tomorrow, a different administration may try to seize firearms from law-abiding citizens or prevent people of certain faiths from gathering to worship, because I will not be complicit in so grave an attack on our system of law. I dissent," Justice Sotomayor said. In a separate dissent, in some of the strongest language of the term, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson warned the ruling poses an existential threat to the rule of law. She writes, quote, "This court's complicity in the creation of a culture of disdain for lower courts, their rulings and the law as they interpret it, will surely hasten the downfall of our governing institutions, enabling our collective demise," the justice wrote. And in another 6-3 decision, Mahmoud versus Taylor, the majority sided with elementary school parents in Maryland who objected to storybooks with LGBTQ plus characters at their children's elementary school. To discuss these decisions and the impact of the Supreme Court term, we're joined by two guests. Dahlia Lithwick writes about the courts and the law for Slate. She's host of the podcast Amicus. She's joining us from Tel Aviv. And Chase Strangio of the ACLU joins us in our New York studio. Let's go to Dahlia first. Your overall response to the last day of the term and the decisions, and specifically talk about birthright citizenship, what exactly this means.
It's good to be with you, Amy. I think that the best way to characterize this is another in a long, long series of Supreme Court aggrandizement of the Supreme Court itself. And, you know, we've seen this theme. Last year, we saw it in the case doing away with Chevron deference. We saw it in the case granting immunity to Donald Trump for the bulk of the acts involved in the January 6th insurrection. The court has for a long time now, the Robert Six have set themselves up as the deciders. And the really frightening new twist in that plot this turn has been the court's willingness to attack district courts, to attack lower federal trial courts as they attempt to be the only remaining bulwark, right? We have a supine Congress. The only thing that has stopped more than two dozen lawless Trump initiatives has been the district courts. And this decision comes, this birthright citizenship decision, comes as the kind of low watermark of the court failing to stand up for Article III judges who are doing their jobs around the country and saying, you know what, in the end of the day, they can't do the only thing that has worked to stop Trump. And moreover, we'll decide if and when some other pathway to get to the courts is permissible too. So we have an imperial court that has created an imperial presidency. And in so doing, it has really cut off at the knees the entire judiciary below.
Dalia, could you also explain the significance? They have focused, the Trump administration, on one phrase in the 14th Amendment, which is, quote, subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Why is that important?
Well, it's not important, and there's very, very little scholarship supporting it. And historically, we know that the drafters and the ratifiers of the 14th Amendment didn't think that it means exactly what the Trump administration and critics of birthright citizenship say it means, which is, you know, that if there is any other place that might have jurisdiction over you, then you don't have birthright citizenship. That was explicitly rejected as an idea. The idea of birthright citizenship was not if any other entity in the world has jurisdiction over you, then you are not necessarily a citizen. Not only was it rejected by the ratifiers, it was rejected in case law time after time and rejected in statutory enactments of protections of birthright citizenship. So there's no meaningful argument for it, but it's being kind of cherry-picked as the way of saying that if any other country in the world has some jurisdiction over you, then you are not necessarily a citizen of the United States. And I want to be very, very clear about this. Scholarship rejects this interpretation, case law, statutes. It is not a plausible theory. And I would add, the court didn't even address that question, the merits of that question. They simply said, we're closing the courthouse door to injunctions. Find some other way to get this urgently important question before the court.
And overall, Dalia, why you were so incensed in everything I saw from your podcast to your writings on Friday, what you were most horrified by, birthright citizenship being one decision, but the overall framework that the court is using.
Right. I mean, I think that we have to be very, very clear to see this in context, right? Because this is not, and it is certainly possible if you read Justice Amy Coney Barrett's majority opinion, you can read it as a very lawyerly, civil pro professors, very, very abstract theoretical application of originalism to the idea that universal injunctions are a recent invention. They didn't exist at the founding. Therefore, they cannot be a means of remediation of problems. But the problem is, and you flag this in the introduction, this comes in a context, right? This comes in a context where the court has systematically, including last week, the same week that the court took away the ability for judges to use universal injunctions, they also, on their shadow docket, on their emergency docket, they undermined a judge, Judge Murphy, in a case that had to do with deportations to third countries. They have undermined Judge James Boasberg, who's been trying to rule on renditions of people to El Salvador. So this is part of a long progression of going after lower court judges for doing what lower court judges do. And the reason, if you look at it in that larger context, and I would add in the context of, oh, come back and do this as a class action, right? Do this as a 23B class action, and maybe the court will entertain it. This is the same court that for more than 10 years has made it more and more difficult to bring a class action. So you have the court that is saying Donald Trump, who's going after law firms that are helping people who are trying to seek relief, Donald Trump, who is signing an executive order that on its face is unconstitutional, Donald Trump, who is absolutely incentivizing people to go after lower courts, all of that is then sort of fed through this lawyer machine and made to look very sanitized. And what you are hearing in that cri de coeur from Justice Jackson in dissent, from Justice Sotomayor in dissent, is he has done something that he knows to be absolutely unlawful. It was unlawful by design. It was done as an executive order by design. And now he's made it impossible to cure it. And if you can't look at it through the lens of what is actually happening, and finally, I would say, through the lens of a Supreme Court 6-3 majority that gave Donald Trump immunity last year, then this is, as an abstraction, a useful conversation about universal injunctions. But it is not without all that context, and it is not without the context that the Biden administration asked the court to do something about universal injunctions, and the court wasn't interested. Suddenly, when Donald Trump wants to do what Donald Trump wants to do, this is an exigent matter. And to blinker yourself to all of those realities and then say this is the correct conclusion, I think is a bridge too far.
So let's bring in Chase. First, if you could respond to what Dahlia has been saying, and then the other crucial decision in Mahmoud versus Taylor. What are the implications of that?
Yeah, so I mean, I absolutely agree with Dahlia. This is a very chilling moment, and I think we should heed the two dissents and take their words very seriously. As an advocate, of course, we're ready to go into court, and in some cases, we already have certified class actions against Trump policies, and we will continue to try to get that relief every single way that we can, but we have to take seriously what is happening from this Supreme Court. And then in Mahmoud v. Taylor, we have a situation in which there is an ELA, English language arts curriculum, that includes a series of LGBT books, really books that have LGBT characters, and all opt-outs were eliminated. So that included religious opt-outs, but any other opt-outs. And I think what's chilling about this case from the 6-3 majority is the way in which they talk about LGBTQ people. They cast these books as coercive simply because they have LGBT characters. And their examples are things like two men getting married and people celebrating the marriage. That is the coercion, the fact that people are happy about a marriage, and the fact that there are trans characters in these books. So we should follow also this court that has continually cast LGBTQ people as a viewpoint and an ideology, not as a community that exists.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Chase Strangio, co-director of the American Civil Liberties Union LGBTQ Plus Project, and Dahlia Lithwick, who covers the courts and the law for Slate. Coming up in the Human Rights Council in Geneva, a Sahrawi tent of cultural resistance has been erected, made from the dresses of 19 Sahrawi human rights defenders from the occupied Western Sahara. Back in a minute.
وتسمع للغزاة صوت النار والحديد
Layoun is on fire by Mariam Hassan, the late Sahrawi singer from Western Sahara. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh in New York.
And I'm Amy Goodman in Geneva, Switzerland. We're broadcasting from the United Nations Human Rights Council. That is behind me right now in an unusual event. A tent has just been erected at the doorway, the entrance to the UN Rights Council, that is made of the malfi, the dresses of 19 Sahrawi human rights defenders, women who have been subjected to sexual violence, political violence by the Moroccan occupation of Western Sahara. Yesterday, I had the chance to go into the tent when it was first erected and speak to the woman, the creator, the Sahrawi refugee who created it. I'm Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! We're here in Geneva inside a Haminta. What's a Haminta? Well, we have the woman who created it here to describe. Tell us your name and what we're standing in. What is this structure?
My name is Al-Asriya Mohammed. I'm from Western Sahara, but I was born and I grew up in the Sahrawi refugee camps. And Haimitna is actually a mini version of the tent where I grew up in the Sahrawi refugee camps. So this is very a mini version of it, and this is a storytelling, human rights storytelling project, which both convey the story of Sahrawis, their identity and their culture. So from outside, it's made from the same material. It's canvas that is typically given by the humanitarian aid, and from inside, and that's what's special about it, it has malhfa, and malhfa is Sahrawi traditional clothing. It's similar to sari. It's 3 meters
type. Women's dress,
yes. And what's special about it, normally we would use normal plain fabric, but the new idea that is that I asked 19 human rights defenders to send their clothing. Textile could be very powerful. It's the most authentic way for these women to be here. They are not allowed to be here. They are all from the occupied territories of Western Sahara.
And it's their own saris, yes. Their own dresses, their own malfas.
Their own malfas, which they wear. I mean, I don't know if we could move on the other side, but in that malhfa there, it's for a human rights defender called Zainabu. And this woman, she sent me her malhfa, which has actually blood stain on it. I decided to cut away the blood, but I still actually have it here. I can show it to you later. And it was from a demonstration when she was violently beaten up by the Moroccan police.
So talk about the QR codes. They look like price tags that are hanging off of each malhfa.
This project was installed in Madrid and in Valencia. When people come inside and you see it yourself, it's very colorful, it's very beautiful, and then people associate it with something positive. But then when they scan the QR codes, it takes them to women's stories, to women biographies, and it, as what was very important for me, Amy, is that it's often that we only show the suffering, and these women, they spent years and years in prison. They have been tortured, they have been beaten up, they have been raped. But what is also special about Khaymetna, that I want to show the strength of them. So most of them, some of them are artists, some of them are singers, some of them are writers, and that's very important for me to also show.
And what's astounding is that this Khaymetna is going to appear at the UN Human Rights Council. It's going to be constructed right next to it.
Yes, and I think when I started this project, it was because these women are not allowed, they are often not allowed to leave their country. They are not allowed to leave the occupied territories of Western Sahara. So for me, that these malhfas or this project, Khaymetna, will represent them. And that's, they cannot be in the UN Human Rights Council. They cannot say their stories. They cannot say their voice, but Khaymetna going to be their voice. Khaymetna is going to be their picture. And again, what is the most authentic way is that their textile, their own malhfa that they used in demonstration and to fight, will be fighting again for them in the Human Rights Council.
Between Morocco and Mauritania.
You've been listening to a description of the tent, the Haima, that has been erected here at the UN Human Rights Council, made of the dresses, the malfas of 19 women human rights defenders. We're joined right now outside the UN Human Rights Council, actually overlooking it, by Maria Carrion. She's executive director of FI Sahara, the international film festival that takes place in the refugee camps of the Sahrawis that are not in occupied Western Sahara, but are in Algeria. Maria, give us a little larger context. We just have a few minutes. Who are the Sahrawi people, and what are they calling for, and the significance of being here at the UN Human Rights Council?
I understand that many viewers and listeners may not know where Western Sahara is or that it exists. It's a territory that is located between North Africa, between Morocco and Mauritania. It was colonized by Spain. And when Spain left in 1975, Morocco invaded with the complicity and support of the United States, of France, and many other countries. There was a war after that with Sahrawi trying to liberate it and decolonize their territory. They were bombed with napalm. Half of the population fled to Algeria, which is where, in the camps where Azria is from, and the other half stayed behind under occupation. After there was a ceasefire in 1991, brokered by the United Nations, and the UN had then offered the Sahrawi people the chance to have a referendum on self-determination. It was a non-self-governed territory. Until now, that referendum has not taken place. Morocco has impeded this referendum from taking place. And
until recently, no country recognized Morocco's annexation of Western Sahara. Then, under President Trump, they became the first country, the U.S.
Exactly. And this was the Abraham Accords, of course, with Israel and Arab countries normalizing their diplomatic relations. Everyone named their price. Morocco named their price, and their price was U.S. recognition of sovereignty.
I want to go to the person who introduced the side panel, who hosted it, the ambassador to the U.N. Human Rights Council here in Geneva. He's from South Africa, the South African ambassador, Nkosi.
The heart-wrenching testimonies that we've listened to from Sahrawi women who are on the front lines, who are at the receiving end of the repression by the security forces of Morocco. Indeed, their voices will never be silenced. The courage of Sahrawi women comes squarely to the fore in the illuminating report, Resilience in Resistance, highlighted by panelists. The report documents how Sahrawi women endure widespread systemic human rights violations for simply daring to resist injustice. These violations form part of a deliberate misogynistic strategy, what the report terms wheel of reprisals against Sahrawi women because of their gender and status in society, in order to instill a climate of fear. This is because through their resistance, Sahrawi women effectively expose the carefully crafted narrative which seeks to whitewash the brutality of foreign occupation. This side event, therefore, is especially timely given that the June session of the Human Rights Council is commonly referred to as the gender session. As such, it is a pity that many states who profess to be advocates of human rights and gender champions are not here with us today. Their absence is conspicuous. It speaks volumes, and it leaves an impression, namely that Sahrawi women, and indeed all women under foreign occupation, are somehow less than human. As a country that prizes gender equality, for South Africa, the violence and discrimination being perpetrated against Sahrawi women can never be countenanced. Indeed, we are a nation born of women human rights defenders who fought valiantly against apartheid to secure equity for women, not only in our country, but everywhere else in the world. South Africa, therefore, is pleased to be associated with this event. This is more so the case as the struggle of the Sahrawi women does not exist in a vacuum, but forms part of a broader struggle for the self-determination of Western Sahara.
That's the
South African ambassador and permanent representative of South Africa to the UN Human Rights Council here in Geneva, Ambassador Nkosi. Maria Carrion, you're executive director of Nomads HRC and the head of the FISAHARA International Film Festival that takes place in Algeria. It's filled with more than 100,000 Sahrawis who have taken refuge from Moroccan-occupied Western Sahara. We just have a minute, but if you can respond to the significance of the South African ambassador hosting this. I also testified because Democracy Now! Is the last journalist to get into Western Sahara, and we did a documentary called 4 Days in Western Sahara, Africa's Last Colony. What people are calling for here?
They're calling for respect for human rights of the people of Western Sahara. They're calling for the UN to have a monitoring system, human rights monitoring system, which they do not in Western Sahara. They're calling for a chance to have a referendum on self-determination for Sahrawis to decide their future. They've been waiting for over 30 years for this. And
the significance of this side panel hearing?
It's important to have also South Africa supporting the Sahrawi people. South Africa is a longtime supporter of liberation movements around the world, and it has always been on the side of the Sahrawi people.
We'll be doing more on this, and people can check out the documentary 4 Days in Western Sahara, Africa's Last Colony, at democracynow.org. Maria Carrion, thank you so much. Back to you, Nermeen, in New York.
And that does it for the show. I'm Nermeen Sheikh with Amy Goodman for another edition of Democracy Now! Special thanks to Poon Echevarri, Romain, and François in Geneva. And a very happy birthday to Isis Phillips. We're hiring for multiple positions. Please see democracynow.org jobs.
Ruth Westheimer. And if you listen to WRCT Pittsburgh, you know that in most cases, size does not matter.